Hello.
How you doing?
We're well.
So this is, I don't know about you guys, but this is awesome. Thank you to everybody for being here. I just want to start out right out of the gate. Thanks to Robert Lane for having us. Marley.
And we're solely first because everybody's here. This is our first audio engineering society show here. There's going to be more, so I'm really elated, excited for all of you guys here. And the next time I think we're going to do this, we'll try to have the other big room done. So yeah, this is Marley Pessing.
She's in charge of my
major part of this whole success of our education academy here. So I'm very, very fortunate to have her on board here. But anyhow, thank you guys for coming. And,
thank you.
And I'm sure we're going to do some really creative experimentation, and some verbiage is going to come out of it.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I just want to say that if you
need
the rest of this on the path here, but you can go through the load-in door up the stairs to the lounge. And there's two bathrooms on that floor. So.
And if you don't have to go to the bathroom, just go check out the lounge.
Yeah, exactly. Feel free. So enjoy. Thank you.
Well, yeah, thanks again. Marley and Robert have been awesome helping out, with the setup. And I just want to say quickly, I'm saying thanks, of course, to our own Rick Chen. If you guys don't know Rick Chen. And also Dan Mortensen back here doing the video. Okay, so let's get going here. I want to introduce our three presenters. The first here is Rick Rodriguez, who worked at Alesis in the 90s.
Yeah.
Is that right? And so you worked on the MIDI-Verb and the...
Well, no, actually, I'm a hardware designer. So I worked with the great guys that actually did all the magic. But, I did pretty much all mixed signal and, power conversion, analog front end as a hardware guy. But we worked very closely with everybody. It was a very tight team. Mainly I was, to this day, I'm more of a hardware guy. I do a little bit of firmware, but kind of a hack at it.
That's the proper way to do firmware.
Yeah.
But you were there.
I worked with...
What was happening at Alesis? You were there.
Right. I worked there with Keith Barr, who was a brilliant, brilliant designer. He was the real brains behind, Alesis. And those of you who aren't familiar with Keith Barr, his first company he started in his very early 20s was MXR. And so he designed the Distortion Plus and the Phase 90 and all these things pretty much in his mom's basement. And, he laid out his own boards, and some of you might remember the old tape method of laying out boards. He did those, and he painted the Distortion Plus. He painted those, hanging them on his mom's clothesline. And he liked the color of the paint was from a Ford coupe that he saw that he liked, so that's how he decided. He used RF boxes back then to paint them. He says you can really tell the vintage MXR gears because they have like little gnats and stuff stuck on them from there in New York. So anyways, that was his first company, and then he did really well. He sold that company, and then he did a little hiatus in the Caribbean on a catch, I think it was, guy out there. And he would tell me all these stories, but he came back to L.A., started a company that made Geiger counters, of all things. Didn't do too well, but then... he fell in love with the Lexicon reverbs, and he ended up making a reverb called the XT1000. It was the first digital reverb under $1,000. It sold for $799 retail. And the rest is history. From then on, he just came up with all kinds of interesting drum machines, MIDI sequencers, and, of course, the ADAT.
Yeah.
And before we go on, if I remember right, Alesis was one of the first ones to do the very large-scale integrated circuits.
where there's a mass amount of code on a piece of silicon. Am I remembering right?
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, the XT1000, their first Reaver, was all discrete components. It was 3400 AC for those, you know, that was the high-speed CMOS. And so, you know, if you essentially, you know, inside was inside of a Reverb, there's a lot of delays, the all-pass filters, and a big ALU, and all this was discrete. They were all discrete little dips. You remember the dips in there. And so his memory, his RAM, everything in an EEPROM 32K in those days, I think, 16K of RAM. And it was all spread out. And now, of course, everything is integrated. He did go, he did evolve into designing and building his own ASICs, yeah.
So I'm going to move along here because I want to get to the meat of this. And then next is Sean Costello. Sean Costello is the principal of Valhalla DSP, and you had a past at ADI, is that correct?
Yeah, I worked at Analog Devices for 6 years until they laid off the whole audio team. And then before that, I'd done some like computer music work at University of Washington. I'd studied some as an undergraduate, but I was too dumb to like... Well, it's like the time I either could be a double E or classical musician, and I was not a classical...
Yeah, pull your mic right.
Oh, yeah. Does that help?
Much.
Before that, I would... Now it's just going to go away. Before that, I was...
You bend it.
I'm bending. Let's see. Yeah, I have to just do this. Anyway, before... I'll just do this while I talk. As an undergraduate, basically, there's a great computer music program, but you either had to be a double E or classical music, and I was just too dumb to be a double E. But I was interested in it, and then it's like at some point I realized I want to do that, so I just talked my way into some classes at UW and then liked it. And so that's just, and then ended up going down the Bay Area, getting a job, kind of learning on the job. Working on the job, getting laid off from the job.
and here we are.
Yeah, it's like
Sean came to talk to us earlier this year, and what happened during that was Renee was there, and Rick, you were there, and you guys were kind of talking back and forth from the presenter to the audience, and that kind of sparked the idea in my mind. It's like, these guys just need to sit down and talk, and we all need to listen and record it.
Guys that actually know what they're talking about.
And that's what this is. Renee, I met at Loud Technologies when I got hired there, and Renee and actually Dave Woodbeck here, I probably pestered you guys like 3 or 4 times a day with questions. I was just chasing you guys down. But it was amazing working there and just being able to ask questions. But Renee... You were at Lexicon about the time they were doing the PCM60. Well, they were doing the PCM60. You worked on the PCM60 and a couple other pieces of equipment that they were doing.
I actually started Lexicon in 79 when Lexicon was actually in the process of making a product out of the 224, the first studio reverb. And I was working at DBX at the time. And I had been introduced to David Griesinger, who was ultimately the architect of all the reverb sounds at Lexicon. And Dave had on his, I went to his house, and in his little lab, which was just covered with the stuff, he had out on a desk, he had a S100 bus computer. And he said, you listen to this. And he gave me some headphones, and he played some sounds, and I said, oh, that's really good. That's reverb. I said, this would be a really good product. I said, I think the professional audio industry is waiting for this. And he said, you think so? And I said, yes. Well, the reason that Dave was interested in reverb is that he had recorded a number of very beautiful classical albums in a lot of the organs around Boston. And he was actually quite an accomplished recording engineer. In fact, he had done a cross-field bias tape recorder back when he was in high school. Right? I mean, he was a pretty smart guy. And I was kind of fascinated with this. So I went back to DBX and I talked to Dave Blackmer, the president. And I said, Dave, you know, I think we should take this on as a project. I said, I can see that you know, we're in the analog world, but the world is moving toward digital. And I said, Reverb is a perfect place, you know, to do this right now. I said, I'm not sure about making audio recordings with digital. I don't know how good it's going to be, but certainly this lends itself well to these Reverb algorithms. And Dave said, well, you know, I'm not really interested right now. We'll do that. We could do that ourselves sometime. So I said, shook my head. Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. So shortly later, I was introduced to Lexicon through a mutual acquaintance. In fact, he was the guy that did our advertising. He did the advertising for both DBX and Lexicon, who were in the same town of Waltham, Massachusetts. So Dick says, look, he said, I think I can get you a good job there. He said, all I want out of it is a 3BX. So he gave me an introduction to Lexicon, and sure enough, I was hired, and I went to work there. And they were well underway with the 224 Reverb. And I made myself useful by laying out the A to D and the D to A boards. The 224 was actually composed of four separate PC boards. One of them was the processor controller, and the other one was the arithmetic unit, which was a complete board of Schottky logic. 5 volts to 10 amps just for that board. I mean, that's what it took to do DSP in those days. But it was optimized just for the reverb algorithms. And so that's how I got involved in digital reverb. And Lexicon became one of the founders of, essentially, the creators of digital reverb for the studios in the next 10 years. So, and I worked for them for a little over 9 years.
And when you started, 79, when you started?
It was 79, yeah, it was like October 79 or something like that. And as I said, oh, yeah, and the owner, Lexicon's founder was Dr. Francis Lee, okay, and he had heard Dave's Reverb, and he, of course, took it right over to Lexicon and said, yeah, we're going to do this, because Lexicon had already built a digital delay line using a shift register memory. They did it for Steve Temer, who was...
It wasn't prime time, it was way before that.
This was just a Delta T, yeah. Yeah. Used anyway. So Lexicon was already, you know, they were already committed to this path of digital. So my main function at Lexicon, since I was not a digital engineer, I was an analog engineer, was to do the analog front ends. And part of that was research into converters. And the 224 used the 12-bit converter, A to D, with a 3-bit floating point mantissa. So basically it would range the 12 bits up and down 6 dB at a time to get another 18 dB. So it got 90 dB of total dynamic range with an instantaneous signal noise ratio of 72 dB. But it worked fine for reverb. And I think the bandwidth on that 224 was 8 kilohertz, which worked very well for reverb. Sounded good. So that's where all that started. And then my job, of course, was finding... better, you know, converter technology so that we could get higher resolution. I did work on the Super Primetime, or its successor. I guess the Primetime itself was already pretty successful when I got there. The Super Primetime was going to be a digital version of that, but it turned out that the technical challenges were way beyond my capability. I mean, doing a sweep in digital, a frequency sweep, sampling sweep in digital was... not intuitive. In other words, what you would get out of it if you did it. We played around with it for a number of years, but I kept trying to focus them on reverb. I said, you've really got something by the tail here. And I said, $8,000 for a digital reverb is great. I said, but only the top studios are going to buy this. This is, you know, 1980. I mean, that's a lot of dollars. So I said, we need to bring the price down. So one of the next project I worked on, reverb-wise, was the Model 200, which incidentally, they have one here, I noticed. It's an amazing. I was not happy with that product, but I did it. I mean,
why weren't you happy?
I wasn't happy with it. I didn't like the interface. I mean, it worked okay, but it didn't bring the price down enough. It was still pretty pricey. I think it was still over $4,000.
Sonically, did you like it, though?
I never played with it that much. I mean, I did the converters and it was okay, but it was that wasn't what I wanted. And so I kept pushing and pushing. And they had a very conservative management. My boss was just didn't want to, not my boss, but the president, he didn't want to spend money. And Ron was a nice guy. I mean, he took me out in his yacht a couple of times. We had great times, but he didn't see the dynamics of the market, that if you could make a reverb for under $2,000, that was the place to go. You know, just get it down, get it down, get it down. I said, you could just sell these things. You know. So finally, I convinced them that I guess the sales were good enough between the 224, and I guess they came back and they did the 224 XL, which is basically a bandwidth improvement. They came out with the LARC, the Lexicon Alphanumeric Remote Control Head, which really made it just so intuitive for anybody to play around with it. And there's an interesting story about the LARC also. Engineering was involved in it. Of course, the LARC was done by engineering, not marketing. Engineering said, this is what we need. This is what it should look like. It should have alphanumeric displays. It should have these controls. It should have these buttons. Engineering... The idea was to come up with a name. So engineering came up with Lexicon Universal Remote Control Head, or Lurch. And the idea is when you turned it on, it would say, you rang? Of course. But marketing heads prevailed, and it was called the LARC. So that I thought that should be an interesting story to pass on, but it sticks in my mind because we just thought it was just a great name. I mean, let me say. So anyway, so the 224 was done. So the 200 was done. We were looking into, you know, bigger processors and, you know, 68,000 processors and so on. And finally, I convinced them to. I said, if we're going to do a lower cost reverb, we've really got to get down. Okay, we need to do some custom parts. Well, what was available in the mid-80s were custom gate arrays. Okay. The tooling for those was pretty stiff. It was like $50,000 a chip. So we had a very smart Chinese engineer by the name of Su Lam, and he had cranked through the timing diagrams for the original 224 using the Schottky logic to make sure it would all work, which is, believe me, is no simple task with discrete logic running at that speed, pushing the envelope. So he sat down and he designed a stuff, and it was his job to interface with the companies we chose for the gate array to set up the timing requirements and so on and so forth. So we finally had a couple of companies that we looked at. And, of course, Lexicon being conservative in the cash sense but not in the smart sense, picked a small startup company in California. And it's like, okay, because they had the best price. So we went with them. And it took quite a bit of time, you know, going back and forth between our engineering and they. To get all the chip parameters. And we designed three chips. We broke it down into three different problems. One was a chip to manage the conversion. And at that point, Burr Brown had come out with a 16-bit DAC that was affordable. I think it was under $20, okay, for 16 bits, which had about... Huh?
Stereo mono?
No, just a single mono. Yeah, just a single. Remember, these were discrete ladder DACs, okay? And it was, so that was available. But since it cost $20, we wanted to make sure we got the most use out of it. So I said, well, we wanted to do both the A to D conversion and then the final two channels of D to A conversion. So my job was to figure out how to timeshare computers. And I'd already been playing with that. I know that there were some interesting problems with time-sharing converters, which had to do with storage times and op-amps and switch, you know, how good a switch you can make, how fast you can switch, the sample and hold problems. But we managed to implement a good 16-bit converter with one chip doing both the A to D and two D to A's. We made a converter, what we called the converter manager chip, or CMU, and that would do all the successive approximation register, you know, stuff, looking at the comparator, checking, and so on. And then switching back and then doing the output for that. So that was one chip. The second chip was a memory management chip, because when you're doing reverb, you're storing and retrieving lots of values back and forth. Okay, so you want something that's keeping track of where everything is with pointers and so on. Make sure that all that stuff goes in and comes out properly. So we made a memory management chip called the MMU. And then we made the arithmetic chip, which was a shift and add device, just like we had done before. So the three chips would do most of the problem. All you need to do is add external memory, you know, some program ROM, a microcontroller is, you know, load the ROM or whatever. And so that was the basic architecture that we picked on. So we went with this first company, and I think it was like maybe 8 or 9 months later, the chips came back. And they didn't work. They didn't work fast enough. We wanted to do at least 10 kilohertz bandwidth. They wouldn't run that fast. So we struggled with it, and, you know, we all looked at it and said, look, you know, we just need to find a company that really knows how to do this. And we had gotten a bid from Plessy. Plessy had done a number of these parts. So we spent another $150,000, and we went to Plessy. Actually, it was about $200,000 at that point. And Plessy did come back with chips that worked. So that enabled us to build the PCM60. The PCM60 was done all on one PC board. And I have a board here. It's not completely stuck, but you can get an idea if you want to pass it around. This is the this was the board. Everything on one board with breakaways for the front panel parts. It had the analog section, the converter section, the three custom chips, the memory. We had 16K of dynamic RAM. Wow, in four chips. They were 16 by fours.
So how much time was that at that sampling rate?
It was about 800 milliseconds, I think is what I calculated. It's pretty little short. I mean, you know, that was one of the limitations, is it could have used a little more memory. In fact, the CMU actually could handle two more bits of memory, so we could have, if we could have afforded it, we could add more memory. And this was the program ROM here, and then all the discrete logic, and then the power supply sections were up here and so on.
So was there a microcontroller switching between the programs?
No microcontroller. Everything was hard switched. Okay, basically when you pushed a button, an interrupt would happen. The thing would briefly stop functioning. We were worried about, you know, well, it's going to make noise when it switches. But it actually turned out is the switching was always done synchronously on the clock. And it didn't seem to produce any bad sounds when you switch between different programs. So we were lucky. We got away with simple, you know, no microprocessor. I only had one crystal running at 9.16 megahertz.
And what was the sampling rate of that?
A little over 20-something kilohertz, 24 kilohertz, something like that.
So about a 10.9K bandwidth.
10 kilohertz, yeah, 10-point-something kilohertz. It had 10 kilohertz, 9-pole elliptical filters, which are these little strips here. They were made by the Japanese. Yamaha made them, I think. And they were like a whole bunch of op-amps and little cans that just plugged in. Cheap, not bad. And so the converter was here, and I used, there was a very nice, very fast CMOS type, it was a MOS type switch, I can't remember, DMOS. It was very fast, very low capacitance that I used for all the sample and hold and the switching back and forth from A to D to D to A function, so I could switch from the comparator to the output I to V converter. So it was all done on one board, and I think the PCM60 sold for about $1,500 at that time. I actually have a PCM60 here.
Oh, right. It's right here. I brought it up.
Oh, it's there. Okay, so that's what it looked like. And this board just sat inside. That's it. And I'm proud to say I laid out this board with a blue and a red pencil on two sheets of vellum. Took me about 6 weeks. We put it into the drafting department. They taped it up, and we went to production. It worked the first time. So that's what engineers do. So you can pass it around if you like.
Can you talk a little bit, because you're talking about the ALU and the MMU. Two questions. It's like, the ALU, what sort of multiplier width did you use?
Well, it was a 16-bit ALU, believe it or not.
Can you describe ALU?
Arithmetic logic unit. Yeah. Or ARU, ALU. Anyway, it was 16-bit wide. I think we were capable of 6-bit or 5-bit plus sine multiplies, which is similar to what the 224 used. And that seemed to be adequate for all of the reverb that we need to do doing the all pass networks. So it was, as I said, it was simple. If you wanted more precision, you just did a double precision function. You just did it twice. You know, but that was seemed adequate.
I just want to point out that the plugins I do, I kind of cheat with a modern computer and don't do high resolution multiplies, and there's still 32 by 32 bit floating point. So the fact that it's like that.
So mimic the day.
Oh no, it doesn't. To mimic it, I'd actually have to put in clipping. I would have to put. I mean, I've done this. I would actually have to sit there and in nodes reduce the band, like reduce the word size in order to emulate what would have been going on. And that's. But what's amazing is that, like, I mean, that's something to talk about. It's like, you know, that there's certain algorithms that work that way, and certain ones that would not at all. It's like that. It seems like there's things that Lexicon and Lesis use that worked actually really well with this kind of reduced, like the multipliers with very small coefficients, and they did fine with that. Meanwhile, if you'd done what's called a feedback delay network, which is more of what you see in the academia around reverb design, most published papers talk about that, those would fail horribly with that. In fact, I mean, there is like, I know that Eventide used a 16 by 16 bit multiplier for a couple of their reverbs, the SP2016 and H3000. And they had to do so much work of just like, how do we scale things down and manage things in order to keep things from just exploding? And even then at long reverb times, you'd start hearing a lot of clipping. So I think it's amazing, like there's these reverb topologies that were designed around what we consider now really limited hardware that still are just like, you know, there's a lark in there. There's larks everywhere. People still want that sound. So I bring that up.
Anyway, well, is it fair to say that how we hit the price point on the PCM60, and for those of us who don't know in the room, there's no variables. They're just presets. It's not like the lark where we can completely vary it.
Right.
That's how we get the price point by making it presets.
Yeah, they're just presets. In fact, if you welcome to look at this later on. I pass it around. It's kind of heavy, but basically there were, you know, you could have a plate or a room sound. You could have four different like pre-delays and four different room sizes, and then you could have some high frequency tailoring and some low frequency tailoring. That was it. But the number of combinations is quite large.
But is it essentially like 64 on 128 presets?
Yeah.
They're controlled like that's cool.
Yeah, right. Yeah, ROM was, you know, ROM was easy in those days. You could just have lots of presets. You know, each one was stored in the address in the ROM. There were four PROMs, okay, in that to do the control. So that the price point was partly hit by that. It was partly by, you know, the mechanical design, making a very simple clamshell structure, you know, trying to do everything, getting everything done on a single board, you know, with the breakaways, so it's all done in one operation. I mean, everything was geared at keeping the cost down as we could in the 80s. This is what we thought would be the best way to go. And it turned out we did hit the 15. Well, we didn't have a price point, but it turned out we were able to sell it for $1,500, which turned out to be a good price point. The PCM70 came later, but I was not, and Sean has one here. I was not involved in that. It was a little more elaborate, and it has a microprocessor in it. The reason, the limitation of the PCM60, if you listen to it for a long time, you'll hear what the limitations are. Is that it's more crude than the 224 even, because it doesn't allow for some interesting tricks that you can do when you have microprocessor control. So what we did actually is we leveraged off of these chips now that we had them, okay, and we had them for a good price. We got a better price when we used more of them. We built the 480L on this three chipset, okay, but it was my idea. I said, look, let's take the three chips. Let's put four sets of them into a rack, okay, and we can do so much more, okay, by passing the data, you know, around and using more. And so the 480L had the capability of split two separate reverbs or a cascaded reverb. I mean, it had so much more potential because it had so much more processing power. okay, there were a lot of things we could do in the 480L that we hadn't done before. Things like chorusing, okay, and of course, by that time, memory had gotten cheaper. We did have the capability to address 64K of memory, which gave us, you know, more.
And how many in and out in the 480L? 2 and 4?
At 2 and 4, yeah. So you could use it as two separate 1-in, 2-outs, or a 2-in with two separate stereo output, you know, reverbs independent from the same set of inputs and so on. So it had a lot, or you could cascade the whole thing into a reverb plus a reverb. So it's, you know, very flexible.
Can you talk a little bit about what, like, because I know this doesn't have a Z80 as a microcontroller. Can you talk about what the Z80 would have done in the, like, the PCM70 480L?
Yeah.
What made those different?
Right. What Dave learned, okay, interesting thing. This gets back to Dave Griesinger, who was quite a clever guy. And if you want to, there's a very good paper that if you go to David Griesinger's website, okay, and you scroll down his page, there's a paper he gives a link to, which he did in 1989 at the 7th AES conference in Toronto, okay, where he talked about his reverb after 11 years. So in other words, it was 78 when he first did his S100 bus. In 89, he said, here's what I've learned about reverb, about doing reverb this way. And he talks about the various ways you can do reverb and why they're more difficult or very difficult or take so much processing power, but why you can make this type of reverb so successful. And one of the things is understanding how we hear reverb. This is the critical thing. And this, for Dave, was, of course, the whole crux of it. In fact, if you go on and you follow Dave's history through the 90s, he's given some wonderful papers about, you know, envelopment in concert halls, the way we hear, the sound, the feeling of concert halls, all of these things, because he studied the way acoustics behaved in concert halls and how we perceive them. And he did it by making measurements of halls, you know, with clicks and noises and so on, and you can, you know. In fact, that's one of the ways we listen to reverb. When he was playing with reverb, he would have a click generator and a boing generator. Boing generator was a raised cosine pulse, you know, of sine wave, you know, and you could tune the frequency and you could control how long it was and kind of make a boing, and you could listen to how that sounded. You know, of course, if it's too discrete, it goes boing, 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 you know, like a spring. But if you make smooth reverb, you can hear this nice, you know, envelope. You can hear the buildup and the decay. The critical factors for reverb depend on who's using it for what. That was another thing that Dave realized. For the person who's adding it to a mix or whatever to create the sound of a hall, it's the first couple of hundred milliseconds. It's how does the reverb build during that time? Okay. And then the critical part of the decay was only when it gets down about 15 dB. It starts to get masked in all the rest of the stuff. So that's less important, maybe. Not totally unimportant, but less important. So it was that first, that critical time, and then the decay to a certain level. Those were the critical things. But he said, interestingly enough, he said, for the musician on the stage, the critical part of the reverb, okay, is the first 50 milliseconds, because that's when he can hear all what the other players are doing. After 50 milliseconds to about 200, we get all confused. So it's that critical first buildup of those first sets of reflections. And you have to play with that. And you can only generate those properly with discrete, you know, you've got to create those discrete echoes. Because the all-pass reverberators take too long to build up to the final density. But you need to create those first ones, and those are critical. So you spend a lot of the DSP capability just creating those first sets of reflections. 5, 6, 7, maybe 10. Okay, that really tell you what the character of those first reflections in the hall are. And those have a lot to do about defining the sound of the space and how close they are, how intense they are, how much they build up. So that's one critical part.
In the first half second.
First 50 milliseconds.
Milliseconds.
Yeah, that's the initial onset. And if you look at reverb, it's that first thing, is there's just all the early reflections. And then after that, okay, now there's another thing that happens in a real hall, in any real space, is reverb echoes are not discrete because surfaces have variations. Echoes are always smeared. They have more than just a discrete time. They start to smear, and the more they propagate, the more they smear. So Dave did a very interesting thing in the when he had a microprocessor available. One of the things you could do is you can make little wiggles in the time, in the tap on the memory. You can go back and forth. And if you can make that like a pseudo-random sequence. If you do that with several...
So you're talking about moving taps.
You're moving taps and so on. So he did that, and he generated... The way he would do the generate the pseudo-random numbers, he said, oh, I don't have a lot of time to generate pseudo-random numbers. But he says, if I just add up the last program, the last 32 bits of the program, word, you know, that'll give me a pseudo-random number, and I can just apply that. So he would do that. And so that when you have the microprocessor, you can keep making adjustments to these things. The other thing that we did in the 480L, which was quite nice, to allow it to operate faster and to make these changes, is that we implemented two program memories, one memory A and memory B. And so when you make changes, you'd make them in B and you'd flip it over when you were finished, and that would become the program. And then you could change A and flip it over. And so you do this all synchronous with each sample. And so you could make that's why the Lark works so well. You can move the faders, and it just smoothly changes from one to another because you flip. Okay. And, of course, the microprocessor has to interpret it. It can't, like, if you push the fader right up, it has to go and do a little. The microprocessor calculates all the steps in between, feeds all those, you know, 32-bit bytes or whatever into the program. Okay, and then it flips it over. Okay, so... You have the microprocessor allows a lot more control. That's why we went to the 68,000 in the 480L. We wanted more control because we had eight of these registers to feed, you know, four operating and four sitting there getting the new data value. So a lot of it, you know, was just being clever with hardware and also being clever with understanding how the reverb worked. Another thing, of course, is that the old 224 worked well because it had limited bandwidth. It's much harder to do reverb as the bandwidth gets higher. Try for 20 kilohertz. You really have a hard time producing convincing reverb because the demands on the accuracy of the reverb and the conforming to the shape are much more strenuous. Whereas if you keep the bandwidth low, so that's why you put filters into the reverb so that as the reverb builds up, it also kind of decays in the frequency domain. It doesn't... You don't have 20 kilohertz bouncing around the hall for 2 seconds. It just doesn't happen. You have too much absorption between the air and things around it.
But so why have it with the higher sampling rate?
Well, you don't. I mean, in fact, you don't need to. And in fact, we never. I don't even know how fast the 40L. I think 40L does 15 kilohertz, maybe.
I think it's 44.1, 48 kilohertz. Was that more?
No, that's right. It was. That's right because we did lock up the standards. The actual bandwidth. I don't know what the filters were.
Was that more of a marketing thing to get?
I think it was more marketing, and the fact that we wanted it to be able to interface to in a digital way to the.
Okay, that makes sense.
We wanted to interface to current digital, you know, consoles or whatever people were doing in the digital domain, so they wouldn't have to go into analog.
Renee, when did Elisa start nipping at your heels on the low-dollar, high-quality product?
Early, right?
Yeah. 84. 84 is when Elisa was founded, and 85 is when it came out with the 1,000. Yep. XT 1,000.
$1,000.
$7.99, actually. Yeah, right. Retail.
15% of your price.
Yeah. Yeah, but Keith admits he was inspired by Lexicon and really gave him a lot of good ideas. So he was the... He was kind of what Electro Harmonix was to MXR. He was at least as was to Lexicon.
Yeah, he used, and it was actually before we did the 60 because, and of course, the thing I found out later on, he only used what like 3 bits or something or 2 bits plus sine. I mean, it was a very simple algorithm.
Yeah, he had
and you could get away with it.
Yeah, it was a very conservative design, and in those days, of course, and then it evolved. More processing power and more integration.
But he figured out some tricks, though, that worked with the low processing. Like if I can get the MiniVerb 2, the MiniVerb 2 has these algorithms in it that are still used. People like it. It's called Bloom. And what that is it's a reverb that fades in really slowly over about half a second and then decays about 15 seconds.
And remind us a minute of the 2?
87, I think.
87.
Yeah.
And part of that is that, like, I asked Keith Barr about that. He said, well, like, that's something that, like, some of the first reverbs he had would just have, like, they didn't even have a multiplier. It was like you could have a coefficient of 1 -1, 0.5, or -0.5.
No, yeah, that was it, yeah.
But if you have a whole bunch of what's called all-pass delays, which are basically have combined feedback and feed-forward so they have a flat frequency response, you put a whole bunch of all-pass delays in series, it builds up the echo density, but it also causes this weird slow attack. And so it seems like basically it's like you could sit there and say, oh, man, how do we get around that? Or like, let's put it in the box.
No, use it as a feature.
Exactly. As a feature that was used by My Bloody Valentine. And these boxes were used all over 90s techno stuff. I mean, it's just the sound that's really unique.
Yeah, guitar players really like them. They're still used by guitarists. And you can find them Craigslist, eBay, whatever, all the time. But they made a trillion of these things. And I actually own a couple of myself. But they're nice. I enjoyed them. And I liked them for guitar work. I like them more for the than the more advanced MIDI-Verb 4 and the Quadriverb.
This might be a good time to ask a question that kind of links into what you just said and what Nay's talking about, where it's like the higher bandwidth of, you know, higher sampling rates, it kind of, I've noticed that if you run an algorithm at a higher sampling rate, what you hear up there is more what you're doing wrong.
Yep.
It's like the artifacts show up. So I'm wondering, it's like, is there something about, and I know that Renee was also talking about the 12-bit converters on the early stuff, and then you used kind of a floating point technique to get higher resolution. I know that Alesis used a floating point technique on their delay memory in order to, like, so instead, it's like that would have been internal to it. Is there something to be said? It's like, is it possible that those older processors, that, because like basically both of those techniques, if you listen to it, kind of gives you a little bit of noise around the delay.
It's not useful.
Hmm?
It's not useful, that high, high, high.
Well, what I'm wondering is if the noise that you're hearing in there kind of helps mask some of the, like if you implemented that in a higher resolution, like floating point algorithm, is it going to sound a little too precise? Like yeah. Basically things like there's some blurring that happens, kind of like a blurry photo, you know, or, you know, it's like, or drunkenness can kind of like make things look different.
Or dithering or
yeah.
Anything like that. Well, there's actually the benefits of a floating point engine. Theoretically, a lot of this stuff, theoretically, you get better signal-to-noise ratio dealing with them. Where if you have a lot of multiply accumulates with fixed points, you could kind of potentially saturate.
But yeah, it's because I know that like like the Alesis stuff as it decays away is pretty quiet. I know that something like the Lexicons, like you've got 16-bit accumulations. You really have to be careful in there to avoid getting like,
yeah.
You know, you can't do some of the tricks that were done. Like you can't have really high all-pass coefficients without clipping. And but is there something to be said about like could that have been helping the sound, or is it just like, or was it just something that you had to deal with, whether it helped or not? It's like this is just the reality of the situation.
Well, like I think what you were saying, it kind of gave a defined sound people got used to, and I think it was overused pretty much in the 80s. You know,
overuse things.
Yeah, especially like reverb and things, the Vangelis, and you know these other kind of very popular music at the time. Pop music was. You could really, I mean, some of it was just drowning in reverb and chorus and effects. But that kind of defines the sound. I mean, you sit there and you listen to it, you can say, yeah. Or soundtracks for movies. You say, oh, yeah, that was definitely the 80s. Anything that sounds as like Chariots of Fire, you know it's an 80s thing. So it's interesting how that that kind of became a characteristic that people got accustomed to.
I think so. I think that the noise was never considered a factor. I mean, look at... a little earlier in that decade, you know, I did the PCM41 delay line, which used a 12-bit converter, but I wanted to get a little more range, 15-bit. So I used a log, you know, a compander and decompander using diode compression. So basically I said, well, you know, you got these top 3 bits, you know, really in digital. I mean, the top 3 bits are just used for the peaks. So why don't you just compress all that stuff, you know? And then undo it after. And that worked really well for the delay line because you end up with storing 12 bits. It's cheap. And it actually sounded pretty good. We didn't do it in the reverb because we were concerned about what would happen when the stuff came back because obviously it had no relationship to the original. So you didn't know. Can't undo the log. But log companding, I was always fascinated with log companding because the telephone company used, 7-bit log companders, you know, and got 80 dB out of it. That's, you know, why not? If you use the actual perception at those top, you know, you don't hear that noise when it's up in the at the peaks. You know, you don't hear the noise down there.
Yeah, when you're talking in the digital world, I most people are familiar with the term signal to noise ratio, but there is a theoretical maximum. Theoretical formula, and it's 6.02 times n, the number of bits, plus 1.76 gives you the
dB,
theoretical dB. That's absolutely theoretical. It has nothing to do with reality.
Perfect bits.
And the adder, the 1.76 a dB is added on as an adder for a full scale, one volt RMS sine wave. So you throw that adder, but you're never going to listen to a full scale 1 volt RMS. Most of the stuff's going to be minus 20 or whatever below your maximum because you have to have a transient and so on and so forth. So you can fool yourself, and that's why things like companders and things would work well in that type of environment.
Hey, listen, we live very happily with, tape recordings and LPs with 70 to 80 dB. Signal to noise ratio. Yeah. And they're fine in most circumstances. I mean, yeah, if you really put your ear there, you can hear the noise, but, you know.
If you don't believe Renee, just go talk to the audiophiles. They'll talk your ear off about it.
Yeah. And more bits is nice if you're processing in the digital domain and you do a lot of processing, because you're going to be throwing stuff away eventually because you got to do roundoffs and dithering and so on. But for the actual final result, I doubt many, home systems achieve better than 80 dB. I mean, you think about the noise of your room and the maximum level you can produce. And, you don't. I'm not going to say you shouldn't have it, but I'm just saying
in reality, we're
very happy with the amount of dynamic range. In fact, I was kind of impressed as that we're getting off topic here, but there's a very nice paper by Gravero and those guys at CBS about the dynamic range of LPs, and in mid-band, they have 88 dB. If you process perfectly, if you cut a clean lacquer and produce a stamper with no excess noise, you've got, because of the RA curve in the place where, where you're most sensitive, the mid-band, you've got 88 dB of dynamic range, which is pretty impressive.
And that's why they give you a weighting.
You're going to weight it because if you look at the Fletcher-Munson curve, when you get down at low levels, you're only hearing, this stuff here, and the rest of the stuff has got to be up there before you can hear
sensitive.
It. So that's what it's based on. In fact, very few tape machines actually could do that.
One thing that I'm just going to speak from a postmodern perspective here, because that's a pretentious word I like to use, is, but one of the things that I did recently with one of my plugins is I started actually emulating, I have an emulation in there of the 12-bit floating point converter. I just put that on the inputs and the outputs, and then I emulate some of the processing. And what's weird is that people generally, it's like you put it on and it actually does give you a wider stereo image. And it's one of those things, like, why on earth would it do that? And I've never seen anything published about this, and I don't want to go off into some, it's like it has to have a reason. It's not like, fairies and elves are in those bits. It's like this is so, but what I'm wondering is that if it might just be that what it basically does is introduces some time-varying randomness between left and right channels, where there's one thing that I think Griesinger actually talked about this, that if you put kind of low-level, mid-range emphasis noise, different noise for left and right channels, and mix it in kind of low in the signal, it makes it a bigger stereo image because you have different things going on for the left and right ears, even though what you're mixing in has nothing to do with the original content. Yeah, but it's different for left and right. And so if you look at these things, it's like the noise that'd be introduced by 16-bit quantization or floating point like AD and DA converters or floating point delay memory might be doing some sort of strange, something different between left and right channels. I'm not really sure why, because I've never, someone scientific or logical would have to actually do a paper on it. I'm just kind of... My stuff's like, I don't know. Will people buy it? Did people like it? Good. It's like, I would love to know why, but it's kind of like, right now, it's just like, just put it, because some stuff if you put in, it's like, oh, that sounds like hell. That's what the real thing was, but you don't have to do that. But it's just interesting to see some of these kind of like, these limitations might have actually contributed something that worked in conjunction with these kind of like the models that they had the horsepower to do at the time.
Well, there is a neglected feature that a lot of the hardware guys, and I know there's a lot of you guys here that really believe in your audio precision, believe in your scopes, believe in all these things. But there is an awful lot of processing going on between your ears that is often ignored. There's a whole science of psychoacoustics behind it.
Yeah.
And there's very fascinating effects. Like there's the Haas effect. Using with stereo headphones, if you have a perfect tone coming into both ears, and you just delay one, like 20 milliseconds or so, it completely drops in amplitude, even though it's technically the same. And I know J.J. Johnson is another expert. He's not here tonight, but he was paramount in the development of MP3s and various compression techniques, and they take advantage of things like masking, sensitivity in the Fletcher-Munson and these various psychoacoustic effects, to where they, anybody I think under 30 thinks an MP3 is the way to go, and it's because they've really done a lot of work in the processing, mimicking the processing goes inside your head. So certainly I couldn't answer your question, but I it's not fairies or magicians in there. it's probably some kind of psychoacoustical effect that I'm sure someone knows.
Now, when you add those 12 dB blocks to the in and out, and you let people listen to it, it's more pleasing to them.
It's one of those things that I think it's like, because you definitely hear it. It's like it adds noise, but it might be there's distortion at certain nodes and stuff. So it's adding this thickness, and also might be because there's like you're reducing the dynamic range from floating point to whatever. Emulating some sort of like transients might be getting clipped because of that. Like transients that like in a pure floating point might come out just nice and peaky and loud. And it's like, whereas like if they don't, they come out kind of less peaky, or maybe they're not going in as peaky. And if they're not going in as peaky, it's not ringing those all pass filters as much. It's kind of like some of it might be like reducing kind of like peaks inside the system. Some of it might be reducing peaks that get into it, because those peaks don't necessarily flatter the algorithm that you have going on. As a matter of fact, like the 224 and 224 XL, they had audio like transformers on the inputs and outputs.
Oh yeah, right. That was that was fairly common in those days to have transformer IO, but. Because one of the reasons was it was difficult to do a good balanced output without transformers. Let me tell you, I went through that. I've tried every balanced output configuration that anyone has ever thought about. They all suck. Transformers work really well for creating balanced outputs. But that aside, I'm just thinking about this 12 bits or whatever, 15 bits or whatever. One of the interesting things to think about is that with all this processing that was going on, and we did a slew of these all-pass things in Cascade with 16-bit, wide word. We never dithered anything. And so I'm wondering if that aliasing that's created actually adds some complexity or density to the reverb. You think about it. I mean, it happened many times that we never thought about dither in those days. Dither didn't come along until people started looking at the sigma delta converters and saying, and processing and so on.
You turn up that reverb. I mean, like you turn up on a 224 XL or on a the decay time or on another place I've heard it, which has a similar kind of floating point thing, is the AMS RMX 16, and there is noise in there.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it's like, and I think, but it's not necessarily noise. It's like it might be amplifying noise from the inputs, but I think it is more just like weird quantization noises and like in all these different nodes, because you're trying the network, like basically a reverb network is you're trying to make it sound as random as you can while still sounding good, not bad random, but like kind of just make it so that nothing rings out more than other things. All the frequencies decay away at the same rate, but they're not spaced next to each other. You really want and that's the sort of thing that, so, like, I mean, it might make sense that if, like, the noise floor or something like that would sound a lot like randomness.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, and no one ever complained about random noise. It's only when the noise gets tonal that it's a problem.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which was the big problem with sigma delta converters in the early days, because they had these little pitched noises. The noise spectrum was like that because of the high order filtering. That's why they went to more bits and people learn more about how to do noise shaping filtering. But
yeah, the Sigma Delta pretty much, well, it depends. TI calls them Sigma Deltas and Delta Sigmas,
Delta
and analog analog devices, but it's the same thing. They were very expensive originally. Less expensive devices, like the R2Rs and the SARs and things, you can still get those today, and they're still less expensive. But originally, the Sigma Deltas, the first ones I used were Crystal, which is now bought by Cirrus.
Cirrus, yeah.
And they were, $30 a piece for these DACs. And that's what inspired Keith Barr when he said, oh, gosh, I can make this silicon. For those that you don't know, Elisa Studio Electronics was the name of the company, and then he did a split where he did Elisa Semiconductor. And
did that become Wavefront?
That became Wavefront and Spin. So the name. But interestingly enough, what we had at Elisa was an electron microscope. That's just what a weird, wacky place it was. And what you could do is you could take a chip, like a crystal DAC, and you could, with some very, very, a lot of smooth techniques, you can eventually sand down the plastic dip package and put on an electron microscope and see the different layers of the substrate that's in there and how it, a little bit of reverse engineering. And, for the purist might say, well, that's, plagiarism or whatever. But, honestly, I don't think there's a hardware designer among us that hasn't done a cut and paste here and there.
I think that's called engineering, Rick.
Yeah.
Called engineering design.
The first thing
you do is look at all the competition and see how they did it.
But that's only 20% of it. If you really want to maximize performance, you've got to know what you're doing as far as a lot of other nuances. But,
sure.
But, cutting and pasting, it was reverse engineering, I guess.
Yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah.
But yeah, so we had this electron microscope. I never really played with it. I was afraid I was going to break it, but I used to like to watch, how it would work.
Wow.
You could do all types of things to get all kinds of good ideas at the silicon level.
And guys, the Sigma Delta, for some of us who don't know, am I right? Is that the one bit? Is that the newer one bit?
Yes, it's got a Sigma Delta modulator. It's actually a first order. The first ones were first order, basically an integrator, a comparator, a flip-flop, and then it would all feedback. And then what you would do is oversampling. Oversampling means essentially is 44.1 or 48 kilohertz is your sampling rate. You would go 64 times, 128 times, 256 times higher than that. And what you would do, the math gets a little arduous, but the concept is good. What you would do is push all the, what they call the Nyquist frequencies, way out there in the spectrum. So that then instead of using these hybrid or elliptical filters, we used those originally, not ellipticals, but we used high order filters. They used to be called brick wall filters. And right at 22 kilohertz, you just had to drop way down. And any stuff that got in beyond, the sampling frequency divided by 2 or the Nyquist frequency could potentially get modulated back in and sound terrible. So the Sigma Deltas, with the oversampling, push that way out, and then interpolating the data or the use that if you're sampling that fast, you have a lot of samples that you don't need, so then you'd have a decimation filter after that, which is essentially would just throw out a bunch of. Surprisingly, what that did was you gave you a first-order low pass with the integrator, and then you would get a high-pass filter for all the decimation. So it's just an amazing – I still marvel at the Sigma Delta.
Well, the thing is, it's simple. That was there was the company back there, Delta Lab, that was doing delay lines based on Delta Mod.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to give them trouble, But basically, they sampled it. 12 megahertz or something like that. Basically, it's a one-bit converter, and you're only sampling the difference between each analog value from sample to sample, but you're doing it at a 12 megahertz rate. You get only small changes, except at high frequencies, they get bigger. When you think about it, the Nyquist frequency is 6 megahertz. You only have 6 dB or so, or 7 dB of signal noise ratio, but when you take that 6 megahertz Nyquist, and you only look at 20 kilohertz, well, you really got a lot of signal noise ratio because that noise is spread out over the whole Nyquist frequency. So that was the basic idea of simple Delta mod.
But was the delay line in those actually running at 6?
Yeah, oh, yeah, they running
streaming. How much memory? Oh, but it was 1 bit of memory.
1 bit. Only 1 bit.
Ah, so
the trick was to, yeah. It's you know, it's almost, you think about it. I mean, they're doing that today. That's what Sony did with SACD or DSD. It's basically 1 bit screaming along at 12 or 24 megahertz, you know, and encoding whatever. Of course, they're keeping all the bits, which is the problem, but it takes up a lot of space. But to get the tremendous signal and noise ratio in the audio band, you have to do some noise shaping, and that's where the higher order filters come in. You kind of push the noise out of band, and then you throw it away.
I think now it's third order is pretty standard in the decimation filter as well. The problem is, you know, in the analog domain, which I spend most of my life, always have. there's a lot of course similarities between the two, and parallels between digital and the analog domain. Of course, there's equivalence between the two, and it's all shown mathematically. But it really is interesting how these filters that you would use, once you go beyond, say, third order, using a single feedback unit, you get real sensitivity. So it becomes kind of an issue to where you could get to overshoot, or you start messing with your, if you look at the S-plane, whatever, you're dealing with this type of thing. But you start messing with, potential, you're limiting your phase margin and your gain margin and potential oscillation. So third order is pretty impressive that they can do that. And these sigma deltas, I don't think they'll go beyond that.
Well, one of the things they did, of course, is they just decided to start. If we start with more bits, we don't need as much filtering afterwards. Right. So most of the converters today use 4 or 5 bits for the conversion, which gives you a lot more to start with, and you don't have to do such extreme filtering afterwards.
But yeah, if you look at your data sheets, you get to go online and look at some of the TI and these other companies that come out with these amazing devices, analog devices. You look at the data sheets, and they'll have that theoretical, or you'll know the theoretical, and then they'll have what they are for as far as their signal to noise, and then that can all be completely destroyed if you don't lay it out properly. So that's really where the analog comes in, where a true analog designer, he's going to look at it from a systems level, from a board layout, from a component placement, and you have to know your reference points, your grounds, and everything, and your signal return. But basically, what it is that the mistake that people make is that what's on your schematic can be laid out, with some auto routing, worst case, and somehow it would work. You're going to destroy 20, 30 dB. I've seen people come back with designs. I don't want to say where, but from that way over the Pacific, come back with signal to noise measurements of 40 dB, and I'm like,
that's noise.
That's all kinds of stuff. That's CBs, ham radios, low flying aircraft. That's everything in the kitchen sink, buzz, hum, power supply, garbage, and it just has to do with the mistakes that you can make in the physical world. So you have these awesome specs with your data sheet, and there's a dozen ways to screw it up.
So when you were doing this for both of you, like doing the analog designs for these reverbs, were you doing, was the goal to, were you just going for, as clean as possible, or were you doing, noise reduction, pre-emphasis, de-emphasis?
Two separate things. Well, essentially from the, from the hardware perspective, you're going for absolute performance and reliability and all types of things. The broader term would be, for any mixed signal, you're dealing with digital and analog. Mm-hmm. And there's a million rules of thumb for this type of stuff, but all of those rules of thumb type of anecdotes are based in real science, real engineering. Dig deep enough, you can find them. And you don't have to know Maxwell's equations or apply these types of things, but it's good to know the fundamental elements and the parasitic elements that exist inside of a PC board or any kind of a layout, because it can cause real havoc if you're unaware of them. But you'll hear these rules of thumb for any person in layout. The main thing is they'll tell you, be wary of where your currents go. Always know that for every signal path, there's a return path.
and for every power supply, you know, power distribution trace, there's a return trace. And you just have to know all these various things. And some people will talk about split grounds on the board or how that's good, how that's bad. Best bet is to start with the device you're using, to start with their data sheet, their application notes. Companies like Linear Technologies, Analog Devices, TI, which is now Burr Brown and National and everything.
Serious.
You call them up and you talk to them, and they're more than happy to help you and give you, you know, because they make eval boards usually and all this stuff.
They also like audio guys.
They like audio guys.
It's more entertaining than most of what they get to do.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, like, when I worked in Analog Devices, it was just like, oh, my gosh, we got an audio guy. It's like, yeah, we got to talk. You got to do car audio. It's like, versus, like, the professional audio. It's like, we really want to work with them. It's like, well.
Everybody likes audio
money
guys.
In pro audio.
Yeah, exactly.
More money in car audio.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like, you know.
That's what my friend over here told me. I said, I'm going to be an audio engineer. He said, yeah, you'll get chicks. No, it didn't pan out that way, but.
Did we cover all of your key questions?
Oh, I don't know.
Sean came up with a few key.
I mean, you guys have been really interesting. I'm just happily listening.
Hey guys, I think now's a good time to break.
Good. Yeah.
And then when we come back from the break, then
we'll see
go through Sean's questions.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So what do you guys think? 15 minutes?
Yeah.
All right, so we'll do a 15-minute break.
It sounds like a great idea.